The feminist agenda. It's now a family agenda.
The opponents to family-friendly policies are often businesses.
A former governor and ambassador on the need to put American families first. Plus, a woman who challenged a president and won. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. In a recession, the need for equal pay for women and programs that help working families is clearer than ever. But in the U.S., we are still lagging behind much of the rest of the world on both fronts. Former U.S. Ambassador and Vermont Governor Madeleine Cunin has written a book raising questions that she says are critical right now. Questions that ask what today's policies will mean for this country's future. Governor Cunin, your book is The New Feminist Agenda, Defining the Next Revolution for Women, Work, and Family. And you are now talking about the policies that need to happen to create equity in our society, not just from a feminist perspective, but from a societal perspective.
Absolutely.
Where have we fallen short, in your opinion?
Well, you know, we made terrific gains for women. Gains in education with 60% of undergraduates now female, with gains in the workforce where women are in the workforce in almost equal numbers as men. But when this earlier revolution changed families and women's lives, we haven't changed the infrastructure of society. You know, the old photograph, family photograph used to be daddy goes to work with his briefcase and mommy stays home with her apron and two perfect kids. Where the new photograph is, you know, both mommy and daddy may have briefcases or certainly rush off to work. And the question is, you know, who takes care of the kids? And what other countries have done that we haven't done is invest much more heavily in childcare, recognize that a new mother should and wants to be home with her new baby for at least 3 months, if not a year in some countries, that we need workplace flexibility, not only for women, but for older workers who may want to work part-time or different hours. So society hasn't adjusted to the dramatic change that has happened for today's families.
And I think that there is always a sense of, if I don't see it, it's not happening. So when you talk about other countries, can you specifically tell us some countries where things are really working?
Well, the most outstanding countries are the Scandinavian countries, where both moms and dads can take time off with a new child or with a family emergency. And the idea to enable fathers to have paid leave is so that, first of all, so many fathers today want to be home with their newborn. They want to spend more time with their families. But secondly, if it's just the mother who gets this opportunity, women might be discriminated against when they're applying for a job because the employer will say, well, if I hire a woman, she may get pregnant and that's a problem. But if the men begin to take it, you create a level playing field. Now, it's harder for men, as often they're the main, still the highest wage earners. But it's a growing trend. So the Scandinavian countries are best. But it's not just those countries. The United States is in very strange company when we are one of four countries that do not have paid maternity leave. Our colleagues are Somalia, Papua New Guinea, Swaziland. So we are really an outlier in not providing paid leave. And that's what's so surprising. We're also an outlier in terms of very high child poverty rates, which hover around 20%. As a result of family-friendly policies, the Scandinavian countries are 3% and 4%. Austria, France are at 7, 8, 9%. So we're going to pay a big price down the line with these children in poverty. And one of the reasons they're in poverty is because often it's hard for a single parent or even a co-wage earner to find adequate child care that enables her to work. So, you know, these conversations about what do I do after my baby is born? Can I ask my boss to work part-time? Where do I find safe and quality child care? These conversations are going on all over America, but they're taking place, you know, at the supermarket. They're taking place at the hairdresser. They're taking place in book groups. But they're not on the public agenda. And the reason I wrote this book is because I want to start a conversation, a serious conversation, about how do we get these issues to be taken seriously in state legislatures, by governors, and by employers.
Well, you have a national and an international perspective, having been both a diplomat and deputy secretary of education, and you know that one of the first objections you'll hear from a Republican would be, we can't afford to do these things. And how do you answer that one?
Well, it is a fair question. And of course, in these times, it's being asked very loud and clear, you know. And I, even as I was writing this book, I every once in a while would pause and say, hey, how can you ask for more when everybody wants to provide, not everybody, but certainly the Republican-controlled Congress wants to provide less. Yes, it may cost something at the beginning, but think of the cost of producing a generation of young people who are unqualified to hold the jobs of today and tomorrow. And the most interesting thing I discovered was that the branch of our government that fully recognizes that is the military. The military sets the gold standard of child care, both in quality and affordability and accessibility. And why are they doing it? They're doing it for some obvious reasons and some not so obvious. There was a study in Mississippi of the rejection of people to serve in the military. 75% were rejected for health reasons, for education reasons, for lots of other reasons. And then the military decided, we got to do something about this. Because if we can't, you know, child care, the early years, are the most important years in a child's development. So if we can provide good early education, good child care for children, they do better in life. And they also are more likely to be qualified to serve their country. And, of course, the most obvious reason is recruits today often are married, have children, and that's the only way they can afford to serve their country is if they have access to safe, reliable child care. So it's a national security issue, and I would argue it's an economic security issue. But the tough part, and I admit it's tough, is to get people to think more long-term. You know, what is the consequence for this country if we don't have strong families, if families can't be given the support to raise their children, which is what they want to do?
Talk to me, too, about the continued impact of wage inequality.
Well, you know, it's surprising. When I first got involved outside of my raising children, we wore these green and white buttons that said 59 cents. And people would ask, what does that mean? It was provocative. Well, 59 cents was the earnings gap between women and men. And today it's either 77 or 78 cents. And, you know, there's some arguing, is it really that big, or don't women just work part-time or interrupt their working lives for families? And some of that is true. But even when you compare apples to apples, you know, a man holding a full-time job, a woman holding a full-time job, you see it depends on the job a large or even a small difference. And these differences also impact how women and families can support their children, because a wage gap is like a tax. Suddenly you earn less than your colleagues working in the same room or on the same factory floor. But again, it's interesting. The wage gap is the smallest, almost non-existent, in Washington, D.C., where you have, of course, the majority of government employees. And, you know, you stop to wonder why. Well, one reason is wages, salaries, are public information when you work for the government. Wages are not public information in many workplaces. In fact, in some states, you are forbidden to talk about what you earn and what your neighbor may earn. So, you know, exposure, transparency, sunlight is the best way to really narrow or get rid of completely that gap. And you may be familiar with the Lilly Ledbetter case.
Mm-hmm.
The Fair Pay Act was named in her honor, and she was a factory worker in a Goodyear tire and rubber company. And it was only 20 years later that somebody wrote her a letter and said, "Did you know that you were earning so much less than the guy who was doing the same work as a supervisor on the factory floor?" It's then that she went to court, and that is what resulted in a federal law.
Madeline Kunin is former U.S. ambassador to Switzerland and was Vermont's first and only female governor. Coming up, part two of our conversation with former Governor Madeline Kunin and an introduction to one of this country's most outspoken suffragettes. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1194. The feminist movement opened many doors for America's women, but according to a new book from former U.S. Ambassador and Vermont Governor Madeline Kunin, the struggle is far from over. The increase in the number of working women, an increase that has become essential as the cost of living outpaces most salaries, has put new pressures on American families. Kunin says it's time for a new social revolution, a change in attitudes and in policies that puts America's families and its future first. Governor Kunin, in your opinion, why is it this still doesn't really outrage most people?
Well, that's a good question. I think a lot of people aren't aware of it. You know, I think a lot of people assume, well, that's old hat. We've come a long way, and we've settled all that. And, you know, wage discrimination can be subtle, that some people still think that a woman may not be an essential earner. I think the old thinking of, you know, the father or the man really needs the money. And maybe the woman is just sort of a pleasant, nice auxiliary, what we used to in the old days call pin money. But, of course, that's changed dramatically as women are co-earners and sometimes earn more than their spouses or partners. So it's a different world, and I think it's people have just woken up to that. But there's another wage gap that is equally important, and there is a pay gap between mothers and non-mothers in the workforce. There's still a sense that mothers, you know, may take off any moment, or mothers can't travel, or mothers don't get promotions, but it's as big or bigger than the wage gap between women and men, between the one between mothers and non-mothers.
Do you see any traction for this issue politically?
Well, you know, both political parties are keenly aware of the importance of the women's vote. And the Democrats at this point are doing a better job in addressing such issues as contraception and Violence Against Women Act. But the Republicans aren't going to fall asleep on this either. They see the same gender gap figures that have helped Democrats in all recent elections. So I think the only way to get their attention is to say, where do you stand? Where do you stand on the wage gap? Where do you stand on subsidizing child care to make it more affordable? Would you believe in a policy that would make workplace flexibility more available? And, you know, just like special interest groups, and women, of course, are not a special interest group. They're 51% of the population. We have to pin them down and say, you know, you'll have my vote if you support these issues. It is, at the present time, kind of a David and Goliath situation, because the opponents to family-friendly policies are often businesses. Not all businesses, but the Chamber of Commerce, the Business Roundtable, you know, the Goliaths in the field always say this will be a job killer. And the evidence is really to the contrary. What I find fascinating is that some of these same businesses who say we can't possibly afford to give you workplace flexibility or paid family and medical leave, which they wouldn't even have to pay for if we had a small tax system as they do in other countries. But nevertheless, they would oppose it. But when they work in other countries, whether it be Germany or France or one of the Scandinavian countries, their employees there get these benefits. And I suspect they wouldn't have factories or businesses around the world if it wasn't profitable for them to do so. So if they can do it for a mother in England or a mother in France or Austria or Switzerland even, why can't they do it for mothers in the United States? So that's a point I think worth exploring and digging in to see if we can't convince them to do the same for their American employees that they do overseas.
Madeleine Cunin is the former U.S. ambassador to Switzerland and former governor of Vermont. She's currently affiliated with the University of Vermont. Her book is The New Feminist Agenda, Defining the Next Revolution for Women, Work, and Family. It's published by Chelsea Green Publishing. And finally, there were many heroic women who were responsible for the rights modern women take for granted today. This week, Gilles Malkin introduces us to Alice Paul, a young woman whose dedication to the cause of women's suffrage led to a hunger strike and mistreatment that shamed a president into a change of heart.
Alice Paul was born on January 11, 1885, in Morristown, New Jersey, into a world in which women were set quite apart from men. Regardless, she studied at Swarthmore and earned a doctorate from the University of Pennsylvania in 1912. She was raised in a wealthy farming Quaker family. She was first exposed to the quest of women's rights by her mother, who was a member of the National American Woman Suffrage Association and who brought Alice along to their meetings. Women didn't vote. The women's suffrage movement had started in 1848. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony were the founders, but had not really taken hold until after the Civil War. The torch was passed along to others to carry, and at the point that women were granted the vote by law, it was largely due to the work of the tireless Alice Paul. Alice Paul said that America was not a democracy until women had the vote. "It's complicated," she was told. "There's nothing complicated about ordinary equality," she said. The woman suffrage movement had undergone a major split. The other leader, Carrie Chapman Catt, and some of her associates decided that going for broke with a demand for a federal amendment could be too easily defeated, and all the eggs would go with the basket. She favored including the grassroots state-by-state legislative approach. But Alice Paul thought this would take too long. She believed in stoking up the fire, getting the iron hot, and then striking while it was. She also believed that she had the ability to get a federal amendment through the Congress. In 1913, she broke away from the National American Woman Suffrage Association and soon formed her own group, the National Woman's Party. They began picketing the White House, which was a new tactic. President Wilson would politely acknowledge their presence when he passed, but nothing more. The war erupted in 1917, and bystanders who thought it was unpatriotic to do such a thing in time of conflict attacked the picketers. But by January of 1918, the president sided with the cause and the 19th Amendment. This change in politics was largely thanks to the methods of the Virginia correction system, which sent the women to a workhouse where even the frail and elderly among them were treated in such a manner that generated public outrage, including keeping them in cold and rat-infested cells, beating them, and when they resorted to hunger strikes, brutally force-feeding them. The 19th Amendment was passed in 1920, coming to the state of Tennessee for the tie-breaking vote. It was young Harry Byrne, the youngest among the state assembly, who cast a deciding vote ratifying the bill, having received a telegram from his mom asking him to do so. Hardly one to rest on her laurels, Alice Paul proceeded to earn 3 law degrees and traveled extensively, promoting women's rights in other countries. In Geneva, Switzerland, she established the World Women's Party in 1938. It was in great part thanks to her efforts that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 included gender as a condition that could not be the basis for discrimination. It is due to her work that the preamble to the United Nations Charter includes a clause affirming equal rights for women. In 1923, she authored what has become known as the Equal Rights Amendment, or the ERA. This law states that men and women have equal rights throughout the U.S. and any other place it has jurisdiction, and that this equality shall not be abridged or denied by the United States or any state on account of sex. The ERA was ratified by 35 of the needed 38 states to become law and has yet to attain that number. Arguments rage as to whether or not the original 35 approvals could still be counted if 3 more states were to approve, and whether or not Congress can change the time limits for approval. Alice Paul continued working for women's rights all her life. She died in 1977 in New Jersey at age 92. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Gilles Malkin is a writer and musician. He lives in New York's Catskill Mountains. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also find a regular column related to 51% at feminist.com. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.